It's fascinating to me how the Lord works things out. All of the talk about children this morning and orphanage and the job that David is going to be interviewing on that very much involves guiding young people in sometimes in difficult circumstances. The other interesting thing that's happening this month, God is orchestrating a missions month for us. And I think it's something we need to be open to. On the 19th, Emma Kuypers is going to be working with Jim Hartley. I'm not exactly sure what their plan is, but Jim is scheduled to preach, and he's in touch with Emma. Emma's going to be with us in worship that Sunday to at least share some. I'm not sure how they'll work it out about Emma's program. And I got an email later in this week, the end part of this week, that Dan and Carol Brown are going to be here on the 26th. So Lord willing, we'll work something around that, and they'll make it, and everything will go smoothly because they got a lot of travels and things, and you can't be certain things can change. But so I'm talking to the elders. They may not have looked at our emails yet, but they got one yesterday that said, hey, you know, God's doing these things with missions, and maybe we better be open to it. So I'm going to talk to the elders and then talk with Dan and Carol and plan the 26th along that mission focus. I know we'll be working with that one way or another, and I'm really looking forward to that. Some of you may or may not know, but Denise and I care very deeply for Dan and Carol and admire their work very much. Always have. It's always been a good couple, good, deep, dedicated folks to the Lord. So things to look forward to. People that have been sent out are coming back. Now, I want to ask you a question. Do you always agree with Jim Hartley when he preaches? Jim is aware. We've been communicating about Matthew 18. So I spoke with him, and he's probably going to listen to this. One of the things that's fun about working with Jim is we have conversations about what we're doing. And I just sent him an email. He's off to correct advanced placement economics test that he put together, and he's over in Ohio doing that. And I know when Jim talks, the basis of the knowledge that he's coming from is always quite accurate, but sometimes perspective I may or may not agree with. So I have that freedom. But what I do want to emphasize, if you were surprised last week about the point of view that Jim took on children, I was thinking, that's interesting. But he's absolutely right about the Gentile mindset towards children. If you recall, it's the children were low and thought of as not worth much in the Greek and Roman cultures. And that's good to bear in mind, because if you think about Palestine at the time of Jesus, Palestine was permeated with Romans and the Greek culture prior in the last the couple of centuries before Jesus' time. Greek culture permeated the Palestinian area and influenced the Jewish people very deeply. And so, to affirm what Jesus said, I wanted to read a couple of things from William Barclay from his Ephesians commentary when he's talking about children and family relationships. Barclay says that the children were in rough shape, perhaps, in that time. There was the Roman patria protestus, I'm not sure how to say words like that. And that meant the father's power. The Roman's father had this incredible power that he had absolute control, power, say, over his family. He could sell his children as slaves if he wanted to and make them work in the fields and even place them in chains. This is the Roman way that kids might possibly be treated. He could punish them as he liked and could even inflict the death penalty on his own children. So, the Roman point of view, and continues. There was a custom of child exposure. When a child was born, it was placed at its father's feet. And if the father stooped and lifted the child, that meant that he acknowledged that he wanted to keep it. So the child's placed at his feet, he could pick it up and embrace it, and he's going to keep it. But if he turned and walked away, that meant that he refused to acknowledge the child, and the child could quite literally be thrown out into the street. So Jim had some points there, didn't he? Finally, the ancient civilization was merciless to the sickly or deformed child. Seneca the Roman wrote, "We slaughter a fierce ox, we strangle a mad dog, we plunge the knife into a sickly cattle lest they taint the herd," kill them, right? Kill the cattle. "And children who are born weakly and deformed, we drowned." So that was the Roman senator, right? Seneca. So the children were perhaps in danger. You never knew what would happen. And so those cultures permeated the Palestinian and Jewish population in all of Israel, from Galilee down to Jerusalem. Galilee was known as Galilee of the Gentiles, not so much because all of the population was Gentile, but because the Gentiles had permeated so much the society of Galilee and influenced it. So those, you know, that was all valid. And Jim was absolutely right in the sense that if we are going to be great in the kingdom of heaven, and let's look at Matthew chapter 18, was the context of what Jesus said. Matthew chapter 18, verse 1. "At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' And he called a little child and had them stand before them and said, 'I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven.'" So the children, particularly in the Greek and Roman society, were very vulnerable and not considered worth a tremendous amount. Jim was right about that society, that point of view. And Jim was also absolutely right about this thing that we have to recognize that we need to be humble, that we need to not think too highly of ourselves, that we need to really see ourselves as nothing, empty ourselves. He talks about Jesus emptying himself of his deity, call it the kenosis, the emptying, so that he could become a human being. Well, we have to empty ourselves so that we can reflect the light of God, the light of Christ, that we can be great not in of ourselves, but there would be a glory because we're a people that are humble and reflect back the glory of God. All of those points I absolutely agree with Jim on. But there is the Jewish point of view of children, which also Jesus was steeped in, and I believe his disciples were steeped in. Although you can argue when the disciples, Jesus had the children coming to him and his disciples rebuked the people who brought the children, the disciples may have missed the boat a little bit, but there is a very strong care and concern for children in the Hebrew Scriptures. If you think about when Abraham was called to sacrifice Isaac, God said to Abraham, "I want you to bring Isaac, the son that you love, and offer him as a sacrifice." There is an affection for children that we see in the patriarchs. The son that you love, God spoke, "I know you care deeply." So there is that concern in the Jewish culture. And then you have Abraham, Isaac. Isaac had Esau and Jacob as his sons. Isaac loved Jacob, right? Rebecca, Isaac's wife, loved Jacob. There was a little conflict there, but there was this parental affection for the children. And then it goes on, if you think of Jacob, the name was changed to Israel, and all of his sons, and particularly his son Joseph, but all of his sons, Jacob had a deep affection for his children. So in the tradition of the patriarchs, the ancient Jewish folk, there was this affection and concern for children. And we're all familiar, I think, with Deuteronomy chapter 6, where there's instruction about how the Jewish household was to be, how life in the Jewish family and community was to be. Deuteronomy chapter 6, I want to share that with you. Deuteronomy chapter 6. "These are the commands, the decrees and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess." They're entering into the promised land. "So that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live, by keeping all of his decrees and commands that I give you, so that you may enjoy a long life." Notice the emphasis on children. So your children and your children's children can follow the Lord. This family idea was important. Verse 3, "Hear, O Israel, and be careful to obey, so that it may go well with you, and that you may increase greatly in the land flowing with milk and honey," the promised land, "just as the Lord God of your Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you." In verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind, all your strength. These commandments I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. There is a tradition, a custom, a heritage of the Jewish people to keep God front and center and have that be a family affair, a family concern. I don't remember what the context was, but at our HBF, Julie was talking about how so often in the scriptures you see this relationship with God, kind of if you think about the cross vertical, and then often moving to relationship with one another. And that's what you see in Deuteronomy chapter 6, taught there, honor God, care for your family, care for your community. And so it's interesting, too, if you follow Matthew 18, we have this beginning about how would one be great? Well, one would be great by humbling themselves as a little child. But we'll see that it goes from that open relationship with God to a concern for others as we move through Matthew chapter 18. So I want to look at it again, and I'll read it again, Matthew chapter 18, verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child and had him stand among them. What's interesting here is if you look at the Mark passage in Mark chapter 10, I believe, there's a lot of parallel passages in the scripture. If you look at what happened there, Mark chapter 9, I'm sorry, you have the same situation. And when Jesus called the disciples around, it said, first, he sat down. Now, do you recall the Sermon on the Mount? Jesus sat down to deliver the Sermon on the Mount. And when Jesus sat down and called his disciples around him, he was treating them as, or he was giving them his official teaching, his important teaching. So if you imagine this in your head, Jesus seats himself, he has his disciples gather around. You want to know another interesting thing about this was disciples were thought of as the rabbi's children. So there was this family interest, there was this view of the disciples of a rabbi being children coming around him, children sitting at his feet. This was all in the Jewish mind. So when Jesus sat down, he was the rabbi and his children, his disciples, were coming around him. So all these images are in this too. And then what does he do? He takes the little child and puts him there in their midst. So in the Jewish culture, the children are valued. Valued. They're not elevated, but they are valued. And Jesus has gathered his disciples, his children, then he literally takes a child and puts them in their midst. And he tells them, verse 3, I tell you the truth, unless you change, and that word is really important, that word means to turn. It's the same thing as repenting. So you're moving along and you think you got control. We were talking about control, right? Karen was talking about control of our lives. We have this idea. But Jesus is saying, no, you need to turn. You're going ahead with your life. You need to turn around and rethink things. You need to look at this child and you need to become like this child, humble and dependent. You need to turn and be like little children or you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Unless you turn around and change your ways and become humble, he says, verse 4, therefore whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So there's a lot of ramifications to this passage, both from the Gentile point of view and for us today, thinking about what Jim brought out about the Greek and Roman culture and the way that they viewed kids, think about our society and our culture and the way our culture is permeated with all kinds of strange values and difficulties and alternative ways of looking at things to the point where we've really become a minority when we try to live by the scriptures or try to live in the way that the Jews were called to live, the ancient Hebrews were called to live under the authority of the word, teaching our children to follow God, to make that their highest priorities. The society, not so much. If God is considered at all, he's a compartment on the side, and we plunge ahead with our lives, very often in the mindset of most people, right? So we have a different set of circumstances to live with. Now, what's fascinating about this passage is Jesus first directs his attention to the disciples and says, you've got to turn and be like a little child. And then his focus turns to the little child. Okay, so you have a relationship thing. You have the relationship with God. Got to get that right. You got to turn. You got to be humble. You got to walk with God. You got to listen. You got to be around me as my disciples. And you got to be open and learn my ways and my teaching. As a good Jewish person would, and we're going to have more, right? Because Jesus brings his teaching. Then he focuses, okay, he's turning in a way, from the disciples to the child with this concern for the child. And whoever welcomes, verse 5, a little child like this in my name welcomes me. Now, Jesus isn't saying the children are great. He's saying the children are to be highly valued. We are to love Jesus, right? We are to love God, right? Well, when we look at a little child, we need to think of them as a child of God, the potential of someone to become a follower of God, the potential of someone to have a certain greatness and glory because God can form them and bring them into his image and work through their lives so that their lives might reflect his glory. That's what Jesus says. He wants that child to become a part of his family, and he wants his disciples to be very cognizant, very aware of that. Very important. Value these children. Welcome them. You welcome me. Just a little aside here. David sharing this morning about his job opportunity, and it's a big decision. And it's a good thing to pray about, because being an administrator in a junior high level or middle school level is such a challenging job. But you talk about being salt and light in the world. And there's so many people here that are involved one way or another in educating young people. One of the things that I appreciate about being here is that I feel like I do my best to try to encourage all of you, and almost everyone here has a responsible job or is looking for one or would desire one where they could serve others, and then so many in education or academics one way or another, or folks who are even teaching their children at home. That to me is very admirable and very significant and very important and very much fulfilling this word. So if I can encourage you, I'm grateful for the possibility, but really it's Jesus encouraging you, I hope and trust. Okay, so we have this positive stuff, but again, Jesus turns a corner. See the child, you welcome him, you welcome me. There's a desire we see to embrace children, right? Jesus says, let the children come to me and do not hinder them. Jesus said, let the children come to me and do not hinder them. Verse 6, but if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, that really means to stumble, or to fall down, or to fall away. It would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. There's a millstone. Okay, Jesus is saying, if you cause one of these little ones to stumble, to fall, if you cause them trouble, if you misdirect them, if you harm them, listen, it would be better to have a millstone tied around your neck. Now, this millstone may be a little bigger than what Jesus had in mind, because if you know the ancient world, all the people would be very familiar with a few kinds of millstones. There would be two millstones, and this would be one side of a millstone. You'd stack them like this, right? And you'd grind, and there were hand grinders. The millstone would probably be about the size of the communion cup that a hand mill. But what Jesus was talking about was a donkey millstone, literally. So it might not be quite as big as this. It would be the size stone that a donkey could pull around a mill. So you know how the mills work? The two stones are together. You pour in the grain, and it grinds it into a flour so that you can make bread, right? So, but the people of Israel, they would see millstones all over the place. This would be vivid and real to them. Tie that around your neck, throw you into the sea. You'd be better off to do that than harm and not show concern or care for one of these little ones. It goes on. You remember the perfect storm slides I put up a few, it was actually a couple months ago, where you had the raging and storming seas, and you had the boat that I described that we had in Boston, because I'm in the seafood industry. There's like these 45 to 55 or even 60-foot boats that can get tossed and turned by the sea, and you have Jesus' boat that he went out with a fisherman that probably was about from where Marvin's sitting to the end of the chairs here. You have 4 to 6 foot waves, and sometimes the waves in the sea get up to 30 feet and can just swamp and destroy boats and cast people into the sea. Well, the perspective on the sea for the people of ancient times was different than ours. A lot of times we think of the ocean as a place where we go for peace and respite. That really didn't develop. Jim was talking about things didn't develop about, you know, the way you look at children, how we think of them as the nice little cherubs, until later on. Well, the idea of going to the ocean to enjoy it really wasn't a popular idea until almost modern times. The sea was a place to be feared. The sailors went, and if you remember the shipwreck with Paul, half of the people on the boat roughly probably didn't even know how to swim. They were sailors, but they didn't set foot in the water. It was just what was underneath the water. It was a mystery. It was scary. They'd pull things out of the ocean. They'd fish, and they'd pull the things that they wanted. But sometimes they would pull big stuff out of there, like sharks and different things like that, predator fish, all kinds of stuff. So underneath the waves of the sea was not, they didn't have, you know, the Jacques Cousteau. Does anybody remember Jacques Cousteau? Who's a modern explorer? I don't know. But they didn't have that mystical viewpoint or that wonder about that. They had fear of the sea. So when Jesus says, you're going to have a millstone cast around your neck and you're going to be thrown into a frightful oblivion abyss. That's good. A frightful, oblivious abyss. A bad place if you cause one of these little ones to trip or to stumble. You know, think back to the Deuteronomy. They need to teach their children the way of God. And not doing so is the first way that you cause children to stumble. He goes on. Warnings first, and then woes. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come. Parents, there are so many ways, and all of us, because we're all children. I was looking, actually, to research a type of fish this week. Now, I'm not going to say anything about it, what the name of it was, because I don't want to conjure up any images. But I used a certain phrase, and this never happened to me before, but it's okay, Google, and said my phrase, and what Google misunderstood me. And all sorts of interesting and things that I should not look at, possibilities. I didn't have to point and push it, and I didn't. But all of these options to look at things that are not good for us, that aren't good for our hearts and minds. It just says right here, because the world, there's things must come in the world. Things will come into our lives and try to get into our homes and try to get into our families. It's out there all over the place. But woe to the person who causes these things to happen. Don't be involved with it. Don't touch it. And I would encourage parents, you know, Paul says when he's talking about raising children and family life, he says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And children, obey your parents, because that's a promise. If you obey your parents, things will go well with you. So there's that. But it also says, father, do not exasperate. Do not annoy your children. So there's supposed to be this nurturing care, but part of that is discipline and control too. You have the right, every right to oversee what is in and around your home, what comes in. And I haven't, this didn't exist when my son was growing up. He's just a little bit prior to all that easy access to the internet when he was growing up. But man, those guards and those blocks, learn about them. Because you don't want some of this stuff that I could have put my finger on just by asking about a fish. And bam, you're involved in a thing that can open every kind of stumbling block and take you into all kinds of wrong directions. It's a dangerous world when the world, in the sense of we think the Greek or Roman culture, and now just our own strange, messed up culture, can permeate our hearts and our lives and our homes. We need to guard. We need to be very careful guards of our homes. We need to be vigilant. Okay, it goes on, these warnings. Jesus just look at it. He says, woe to the person through whom these things come. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life maimed and crippled than to have two hands and two feet and be thrown into the eternal fire. Jesus is real serious. And if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and to be thrown into the fire of hell. And we know that this is hyperbole or exaggeration. Jesus doesn't expect us to maim ourselves literally. We know that because no disciples ever did after Jesus' time, right? There's no record of people damaging themselves so they wouldn't sin. Although some of the Desert Fathers later on got a little carried away. What this is just really strong warnings. And when it says eternal fire, there again, we don't have the images that the disciples and the people around Jesus would have had. The word is Gehenna, and that is the refuge dump outside of Jerusalem. So it'd be better for you to be thrown into hell, we translate it, but it is really Gehenna, or the refuge dump that was always burning with this undying fire. So if a person was thrown into that, he was being thrown into the refuge pile where there would be torment. And Jesus is warning, look, the consequences of not caring, nurturing, and taking care of these little ones is severe. Take me seriously. Don't cause any of these little ones to stumble. So in approaching the communion table this morning, I want to share again from Mark chapter 9. Or chapter 10, I'm sorry, this time. Mark chapter 10, starting at verse 13. I want this image to be in our minds as we approach the communion table. Mark chapter 10, starting at verse 13. People were bringing little children to Jesus. And Luke translates it babies or infants. It's almost like child dedications. Jesus was bringing these, or people were bringing these little ones to Jesus to have him touch them, take them into his arms. But his disciples rebuked them. Again, the disciples, this is after Jesus took that little child and put them in the midst of them. So, you know, we can look at the disciples as being slow, but sometimes I know I'm slow too, right? But he said to them, the disciples and all the people, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them. Don't do anything to stop a child from coming to Christ. Don't do anything to cause them to stumble or fall away. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. I tell you the truth, anyone who will not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it. And he took the children into his arms and put his hands on them and blessed them. So Jesus has this incredible concern, right, for the little ones. But you know what? All of us to Jesus are little ones. All of us to Jesus are ones who need his help and guidance. All of us are ones that need to be in that circle where Jesus is seated and we can sit around, sit at his feet and listen. We need to be those little children too. And great, later on, Jim and I are probably going to be looking into the Upper Room Discourse where Jesus says, I will not leave you as orphans, but I will come to you. That when Jesus says, I will not leave you as orphans, but I will come to you, he's promising the future that one day, face to face, we'll see him. I will not leave you as orphans. It's interesting. Bill was talking about an orphanage, and that's a sad image, children who are without family, without care. Jesus promises, I will not leave you as orphans. I will take you into my arms as children.